Welcome to the Sourcing Hero podcast, produced by UNA, a group purchasing organization that empowers sourcing heroes, and Art of Procurement, the world's largest procurement podcast network. I'm your host, Kelly Barner. The goal of the Sourcing Hero podcast is to capture the epic stories of people who are rising up and beating the odds to create exceptional value within procurement, directly from those heroes themselves. Today, my guest is Kate Vitasek. Kate has been the driving force behind the University of Tennessee's pioneering research and development of the award-winning vested and vested outsourcing movement. Her insights have been widely published in over 300 articles in respected academic and trade journals, as well as in 7 books. She has appeared on Fox Business News, CNN International, NPR and Bloomberg Radio, and has been featured in Harvard Business Review, Forbes, Chief Executive Magazine, Contract Management, CIO Magazine, World Trade Magazine, and Information Week. Hi, Kate. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to share a little bit about our work and research at the University of Tennessee.
So, Kate, in my intro to you, I talked about some of those amazing places, and there are a lot of them, where you have shared your thoughts and perspectives. But what I didn't really touch upon is how you spend your time. So for any of our listeners that are meeting you for the very first time, can you share a bit about your current role and how you spend your time?
Perfect. Well, I am a faculty at the University of Tennessee in graduate and executive education. So I'm in the College of Business. So even though a lot of our work and research bumps up against contracts, I'm technically in the College of Business. So when I say I'm in graduate and executive education, think of it as grown-ups come to take my class because they have real problems and real deals that they're struggling with, and we really help them work through what's the right sourcing business model, how do you go about improving that relationship, reducing risk, improving the trust and collaboration and innovation that you have. And that's, you know, the background of my research stems from supply chain management. I'm a supply chain girl, right? So I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a contracting person. I come at the problem of why don't some of these sourcing, you know, these large complex sourcing deals, why aren't they working? And it's really from the supply chain, you know, how to get them to work better.
One of the things that I really like about the idea behind vested, and then of course, all of the books and articles and everything else that have come from it, is that while there's this one core central philosophy, right, which you call a vested business model, each of the books is really very different. So they explore all of these different offshoot ideas and strategies. Why do you think this movement, the philosophy behind vested, has been able to expand into so many books and articles and other types of content? What is it about the vested way, to go back to one of your early titles, that captures people's imaginations and solves so many of the problems that business people come into your class with?
Well, if you think about sourcing and buying and selling, you know, we've grown up really since Adam Smith, you know, over 200 years ago, perfecting the art of buying and commoditizing and the transaction. And our world is so much more complex today. We're more global. We're more complex. It's more risky. I mean, who could have ever planned for a pandemic? Who could ever plan for the Suez Canal blockage, right? And so we need to rely on relationships to help us solve problems. It's people that solve supply chain problems at the end of the day. And yes, we can use our data and AI and all this good automation and systems that we have. But the more complex that we have, you know, these deals, there's a people aspect. And when we're very adversarial with our suppliers, right, it's this buy, sell, and it's all about the transaction. How much is it per cost, per widget, per mile, per shipment? We tend to be very arm's length, and we actually erode trust. And think about the negotiations that we have. You know, when's the last time you did a negotiation or took a negotiation class? All too often, the tactics that people teach are actually trust busting tactics instead of trust building tactics. And when we want to have efficiencies, when we want to have innovation, we need transparency, we need trust, we need our suppliers and the people that work there to come together to solve our tough, complex problems and to innovate for us for the future. So this together philosophy that we call vested, you know, why do we call it vested? I have a vested interest in your success and you have a vested interest in my success. It really does work. And we know this from our applied work because we spend a lot of time and energy on applied research, how to actually work with organizations to get them to deliver on the promise of innovation and collaboration. But the concept dates back, you know, forever and was been researched. One of the most famous researchers on the concept of win-win thinking is John Nash. He won a Nobel Prize in 1994 for his work. You might not remember Nash, but you probably watched the movie, The Beautiful Mind. And so win-win isn't something that's new or novel. It's been around. We just have built procurement processes that aren't win-win. And that's time to change.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And it's actually interesting because when you talk about translating this philosophy or the mindset associated with vested into actions and real world value, I think maybe one of the areas where people would not expect this philosophy to come into play is ironically one of the ones where the ROI is the greatest. And that's during the contracting process, right? So you and your team have been researching and writing and talking about relational contracting, which is an excellent place to see all of this play out. So first things first, because this is a one-on-one class in today's podcast, what is relational contracting?
Well, I think you have to understand the difference between relational contracting and a relational contract. So relational contracting is really when the parties come together. It's a process to come together to collaboratively create a contract. It's not arm's length negotiation. You know, all too often the business people sit at the table over a glass of wine, pencil out these grand ideas on the back of a napkin, and then it goes through a procurement process, and then it goes through the contracting process, and what the business people wanted and what they contract for are very different. And so relational contracting is about aligning the buyer and the supplier so that the contract is a more collaborative way of working to ensure that the contract meets the business needs. And a relational contract, so the actual document itself, we define this in the book, Contracting in the New Economy. It's a legally enforceable written contract. So let's put that straightforward. It is a contract. But what is different is the way you actually get there. Through the collaborative contracting process, you're going to be establishing a commercial relationship, a commercial partnership that is very flexible. So the parties are saying, you know what? Business is dynamic. You know what? Business is risky. And so how can we work together using social norms and jointly defined objectives so that when business happens, we can go back and our contract is our playbook for how we get unstuck. Instead of, oh, here's a clause, force majeure clause for the pandemic, sorry, you're stuck with it, right? Instead of using our legal clauses in our contract to protect ourselves, we want to write a contract that says we're in this together and what's our governance structure to get us out of this? What's the social norms and objectives we're going to use so that we can best navigate the dynamic nature of business? So you see the difference? We need a relational contracting process to get to a relational contract, and they go hand in hand.
Oh, absolutely. And yet, anytime we start talking about relationships, I at least always feel this sense of worry that what procurement is talking about as relationships may not feel so much like a relationship from the supplier's perspective, right? So just calling something relational doesn't necessarily make it so. Now, I'm sure you've observed this, but how would you characterize the difference between a company that is truly relational in its approach to working with suppliers versus a company that talks about relationships, but is sort of using some of the older school, traditional, or more transactional ways of actually managing and working with those suppliers?
Well, that's an excellent question and the source of a ton of our research in one of our books, Strategic Sourcing in the New Economy. We actually take the concept of vested and we break it down into 10 elements, 10 contractual elements, and 5 rules. So there's 5 rules, 10 elements. And when we diagnose a relationship, so someone says, well, we have a great relationship. I think this is a vested deal. And you look at it, you can actually see by looking in the contract if they really are doing some of these things. So I laugh. You want your supplier to have innovation, right? And you have a 60-day termination for convenience. So, gosh, you're my strategic partner. I really want you to invest in helping me build the next innovation, but I can fire you in 60 days just because I don't like you. And so you see this disconnect, right? Yeah, you've got this relationship and it's supposed to be strategic, but your actual contract clauses are creating a perverse incentive. The same thing with our statement of works, right? So, oh, I want you to be innovative. Oh, here's the statement. Here's a 500-page statement of work with supplier shall, and I'm going to micromanage you with 100 metrics. So you're going to get the supplier shall and 100 metrics versus working together to solve a problem, to drive innovation, or, you know, smooth out your supply chain because it's all wacky right now. And so you're not going to get this collaboration that you want and the transparency that you want. The less trust that your supplier has, the less transparent they're going to be. And you can't just mandate that trust. So you have to build a process that's going to create that relationship, that's going to engender that transparency, that's going to engender that collaboration. And the process builds what we would call a relational contract. And you know the proof is in the pudding when you open up that contract and it does follow those rules and elements that we you know, see make a difference in wild success and ho-hum traditional transactional contracts.
And yet it's not appropriate in all cases, right? So even an organization that is mature enough and prepared and has the right supplier under the right circumstances to justify this type of approach, you're still going to have some contracts where it doesn't make sense or supplier relationships where it doesn't make sense. How is it that a company needs to approach how they perceive and work with suppliers and understand the value of contracts before they can even figure out if they have cases where relational contracting is appropriate and when on a supplier by supplier basis they should consider going down this road?
So it's a great question. And we are the first ones to advocate that, you know, relational contracts aren't for everyone. And within that, a vested agreement, which is kind of the most advanced, formal, outcome-based relational contracts, definitely isn't for everyone. In fact, we map out what we call sourcing business model theory, which looks at, think of it as a continuum. So on the far left-hand side, you've got your very transactional deals, a basic provider. You don't even have a contract. You're using Ariba or Amazon Business to just go buy something, you know, it's a simple commodity transaction. And on the far, far right hand side of this continuum is an investment-based approach. So you're buying the supplier. It's a joint venture. It's an acquisition. You're physically making an investment. So if you've got these 7 models, in the middle, there's 3 that we would classify as relational contracts. And this would be a preferred provider, a performance-based or managed services type deal where you really are getting more strategic. You're looking at business outputs, you know, service levels against such as a large outsourcing deal. And then finally, the 3rd type of relational contract is a vested agreement. So that is an outcome-based economic model. So you can have different types of deals that are relational contract. And the key theme here is that as you get more strategic, as you get more complex, as you get more dependent, as you get more risky, the relationship matters. So there's different factors that would tell you, I should have a relational contract versus I should have a transactional contract. So the key then is to know which ones of these relationships should be relational and then to create the contract to support it. So you're not saying something on one hand and then writing a contract that creates perverse incentives on the other hand. So you're aligning the contract with the intent of that relationship. And I laugh, you know, P&G has 80,000 suppliers. They can't all be relational contracts, right? And so be realistic, it's like a funnel. So the more strategic, the more dependent, the more complex, the more risky, it's actually better to bring in and formally embrace the relational aspects and couple that into your contract. So the relationship matters. Write it down, put in your contract. Your contract is your playbook for how you work through business problems, you work through innovation, you work through mutual investments.
Well, and it's interesting because I think one of the points that I actually remember where I was sitting when I read this particular point in one of your books. You wrote about the fact that just because you have vested contracts or a vested relationship with the supplier, it doesn't mean that you don't still absolutely hold them to a high standard from a performance point of view. It doesn't mean that you're not still going to negotiate rates. You know, there's still all of those high expectations, business elements in there. It's just the nature of, as you said, the outcome-driven way that that contract is structured. I think that's an important point for us to spend a minute on, because working through a relational model or getting to a vested contract does not mean that the whole situation is huggy and fuzzy and lovey and let's sing kumbaya. If something goes wrong, it doesn't mean that any of those very critical risk-averse or cost-controlling elements aren't in the contract. It's just the nature of how the framework between the two companies is outlined. Is that a question that you get? Do you hear from companies that they're concerned that, well, if I'm overly focused on building a mutually beneficial relationship, then how can I possibly expect the supplier to come through for me or to perform? Or how can I handle a difficult negotiation with them? Is that a question that you hear?
Yeah, it's really funny. Someone actually said, you know, these are hairy fairy contracts. Until they did it, right? It's like, wow, no, there's actually this, there's a lot of meat to this. And so it's this, I don't know why people think just because you use the term relational contract, that people think it's this fluffy thing that you is not a contract. To the contrary, we actually make people think more about what should go in their contract. It's just a flexible contract framework that says business happens. Oh, how do we work together? So the governance structure is very robust. Actually, we take a termination for convenience clause and we actually blow that out. And there's a whole entire schedule on an exit management plan. How, because we are dependent, how do we exit this relationship? What's our roadmap for exiting? How would we think about the economics because we are dependent? And so there's far more words. Right? You take a traditional contract and it's got, you know, a dispute resolution clause. Well, we have an entire schedule on governance and how you actually solve problems at the lowest level and how you escalate them and what are the guiding principles you use to make decisions. And so it's far more intuitive for the business people to have a playbook for how they fix problems and how they would do things than this clause that you can't read that says, oh, well, when we're stuck, we go to court or we use an arbitrator. So we're taking these legal clauses and actually making them usable. So your contract is a playbook. We're huge advocates of plain language contracting and visualization. There's some wonderful research done on both of those concepts. And so if you can take and get the contract to support the business and help the business people understand how to uphold the contract and how to make good business decisions and solve problems when things do arise, you're far better at mitigating and managing risk, right? So people are afraid. They're like, oh, well, there's so much risk in a relational contract. Actually, you don't see these contracts go to court because you've actually solved your problem and you've said, gosh, there's a pandemic. What are we going to do about it? Instead of whipping out your force majeure clause.
Well, because at the end of the day, it's actually about people solving problems, right? You know, we may look at it, especially in B2B companies, as being your big company does business with my big company, and we're going to figure out this contract, and somebody is going to get something, and somebody is going to pay some amount of money. But in these very important types of agreements, it really is about personal relationships, which can't happen without people, of course, and then individual choices and the approach that people choose when they're working together, especially when something goes wrong. And I think that that idea of it being about people actually brings me very nicely to a series of questions that I always ask the guests of the Sourcing Hero podcast. And that's about the idea of heroism in business. So, Kate, out of curiosity, from your perspective, what is a sourcing hero?
You know, a sourcing hero is someone that doesn't just do what's always been done, but steps back and says, what's the right thing to do, and has the courage to do the, not only do the right thing, but the courage to change, to be better, faster, cheaper, you know, and not just rely on a policy that was written 20 years ago, because that's what we do, right? And so I think about the Krawczyk matrix, right? So using leverage. Well, there's so much research now that actually shows that collaboration pays off more than leverage. So why are we still using some of these old school power-based philosophies? So a sourcing hero is someone who has the sense, the courage to challenge and change for the positive.
And that's really hard. I mean, it does require courage to not only do things differently yourself, but then on top of that, to lead a team of people or a company through doing things differently, that is incredibly hard. So for people that want to see themselves in that sourcing hero role, where do you suggest that they find a source of strength or the source of that courage that would allow them to do that? I mean, you focus on research. You've done a lot of writing, you've put together all of these case studies, and you've had experiences with all of the companies that you've worked with. Can you share anything with us about the sources of courage that you see in the leaders that are most effective and how they're able to fuel that courage and use it to drive change?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There are the few that I would call enlightened. And so P&G and Jones Lang LaSalle, you know, I would say they were enlightened to want to challenge the status quo, not because they weren't awesome and were doing a great job, but because they knew there was, you know, they wanted to create something better. Far too often, and it's really sad, is that a lot of times organizations won't change because it's easier to not change. And so you almost have to have a burning platform to change. And so I really admire the individuals who are enlightened. And I think the best advice I have is become a teacher, right? And I didn't used to be an academic, by the way. I was on the buy side. I worked for Microsoft, and then I worked for Microsoft's largest supplier, and I've been a consultant. So I've been in the trenches. And as a younger practitioner, you know, if someone didn't agree with you and you thought you were right, you just try to like use your power, convince them and argue with them. You know, even if you're not really arguing, right, you'd want to get all your ducks in a row and my facts are better than your facts. And, you know, as a teacher, I've come to realize you can't make anyone change, but you can educate people and have empathy to understand their position and try to educate them so that they can make a choice that the path you're teaching is a good choice. Because if they don't buy into it, they're not going to change. And so I would say for any practitioners out there who, you know, the potential sourcing heroes and, you know, having courage, become a little bit of a teacher and don't push, right? Instead, kind of pull. You know, my grandma used to say, "You catch more, you know, you catch more flies with honey, right, than with vinegar." And it's true for, you know, kids. Candy is better than, you know, than the whipping stick, right? And so it happens in business as well. And there's tons of research around that to show that collaboration actually outperforms power-based approaches. And so I would ask people to study up, get smart on some of this, read some of our white papers, our case studies, the research behind it. It's just, you know, decades of research. Ours is very specific research in this field, but the theories and the economics and the psychology research around collaboration and the power of collaboration and transparency is huge. And so use that to help, not in your argument, but to become a teacher and win over those naysayers. And as I like to say, change the world one deal at a time. Don't try to change your whole company. Ask for permission to have a pilot. You know what? We've got this one deal that we really need to make work. What if we piloted this wacky, you know, new way of working?
Well, and you certainly do have a ton of resources that are available. So we've mentioned the books, we've mentioned your appearances in places. There are lots of articles and things that are out there. But if people are interested in learning more, if they would like to connect with you and simply learn more about Vested, where do you recommend as the best place for people to go to connect with you or just to get more information?
So we have, the university has a dedicated website to Vested. It makes it pretty easy to find stuff. It's called Vested Way, V-E-S-T-E-D-W-A-Y, vestedway.com. Our library's on there. We have 3 free classes. And if you forget the, you know, vestedway.com, literally just type in the word vested sourcing, even just vested. It's bizarre to me. This is craziness. On some days when I go do the Google ranking, if you just type in the word vested, here comes the definition of vested, but we're in the top 10. You're like, seriously, the Vested Way of working is in the top 10 of just the word vested. But type in my name, Vitasic Vested, you're going to find hundreds of stuff on the internet. Our case studies, videos. You know, it's interesting. Just this past month, there's someone in the UK that does facilities management. It's like a magazine, and they're doing these little videos of what's your experience with Vested. And so, in the last month, there's been about 8 little videos that have popped up from people just talking about their experiences of using Vested. And so just do a simple Google work, Vested, Vitasic, you're going to find a ton. And our official site is vestedway.com.
Oh, yes. And I absolutely promise you will learn a ton, because so much of what is shared as part of this program is based on the stories of the people and the companies that have built these relationships and then the results that they were able to deliver because they made that choice. So, Kate, thank you so much for joining me here on the Sourcing Hero podcast and for sharing your perspective and for the little bits of research that we could squeeze into this short amount of time. I'm so grateful to you for being here with me today.
Well, thanks for having me, and thank you to all those sourcing heroes out there who had the courage to challenge the status quo, because that's the only way we get better.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sourcing Hero podcast. Join us again next time for more true stories of sourcing and business heroism performed by your colleagues and peers. Look for The Sourcing Hero wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe. Finally, don't forget, sourcing heroism is taking place all around us every day. Keep your eyes open and you're bound to see it. Until next time, I'm your host, Kelly Barner. Stay well, and always remember that you can be a hero too.